A lot of people know, if you guys don't know me, my name is Luke Pugliese. I started last month. So, hi, everybody. Some of you know me, some of you don't. We've been doing these launch and learns, and I got intrigued with ASU, and, you know, obviously the innovation comes from bringing people in from the outside, too. Michael Brewer talked a lot yesterday at a meeting around design, and Stephen Downs is obviously a really well-known guy, not only for the MOOC arena, I'll introduce him in a second in terms of his credentials, but, you know, from a design perspective, he's done some really, really interesting work. First, I wanted to thank Cookie and Kim and Patty for helping to make all the arrangements to get Stephen down here. Just by way of introduction, Stephen, as some of you may know, is one of the leading futurists in online education and digital learning. He says on his website that he's one of the originators of the MOOC, and I think that's a little modest. We could call him the father of the MOOC. So Stephen was doing MOOCs before MOOCs were cool, and it's just one of the voices in the MOOC environment, or in the movement, the whole MOOC movement. Stephen, among other accomplishments, I don't know if any of you OLD Daily. Does anybody subscribe to OLD Daily? Yeah, it's addictive, so you really should. It's one of my things I do every morning at, you know, 6 a.m. So I've been sitting down to OLD Daily. It's really a phenomenal publication. Spends a lot of time putting that together. Some of it's his own work, some of it's authored works by other notables, and it's just really good to read, so please sign up for that. Stephen's working on a really interesting project now called the Learning and Performance Support Systems Program, LPSS, and that's been underwritten by the National Research Council, where Stephen works currently. We'll be involving a lot of people in conversations afterwards around the LPSS. It's really interesting e-learning design and architecture development that the council has sponsored, and Stephen has been working on this for the last few years, well-funded. There's a number of programmers working on it, so it's an actual product and architecture that's being developed, and, you know, I think it's going to be really the next generation personal learning system, which he'll describe today. It's part of the National Research Council. Stephen also worked in the Personal Learning Environment and Resource Network, or PLEARN. He continues his work in the MOOC and OER environment and has developed MOOC software. He has developed a collaborative e-learning workflow and authoring system that was actually commercialized, and Desire to Learn uses it now. Stephen really did a lot of the heavy lifting early on and working in concepts like learning object repositories. That sort of phraseology wasn't around before Stephen, in terms of movable content and extensible content, platform-independent content. Stephen is also worked at the University of Alabama, developed a learning research portal that a variety of institutions across Canada used in terms of learning objects and interoperable design around content, how to move content from place to place. So the whole notion of learning objects is really, you know, involved early on in the work that he did at the University of Alberta. He introduced really the concept of e-learning 2.0, and George Siemens developed that and defined the concept of connectivism. And what I really like about Stephen's work is, and often, you know, sort of undercovered notion of this behavioral science around how students can relate, how faculty and students can relate in terms of the learning experience. It's an area that I have aspirations to do a doctoral dissertation in. So he caught my attention in terms of the early connectivism theory, and so he's done a lot of work. So a lot that cuts across all the things that we do here, obviously, and some of the things that we want to be doing better around the research work that we're doing here at ASU. So Stephen, I'll leave it to you now to kick it off.
Thank you, and back to my talk. So thank you all for coming here today. I see that having pizza in addition to me is a winning strategy. Too loud?
Yeah, I'm going to change this.
Yeah. So, I don't think this will work, but I'm going to try it anyways. So one of the things Lou asked me to do is to talk, oh, it will work, how about that? Talk a little bit about some of the problems that I'm trying to address with the work that I do. Now I've lost it. I'm going to have to bring it back here. And home, library. There we go, yeah. So I want to. This is not part of the regular presentation, but I want to just animate the sort of thing that I've been trying to address, frankly, my entire life. And it's a perfect example. Now, I'm coming here to University of Arizona. Have I got the name right? Arizona State University? Uh-oh. Is there, in fact, the University of Arizona? Never mind. I'm still dealing with heat stroke. So I might actually have the wrong person in the wrong book and everything, but I don't know. But I thought coming down here, I should read Designing the New American University.
That's the right book.
And so I paid, I forget what it was, $49.95 Canadian for this thing. Actual, real money out of my own pocket to read this book. I got it on an e-book service called Kobo. There it is. And that's what I got. I don't know if you're going to read it. Instead of my book, I got something called Orient Lex, and the small print there reads, Near Eastern Influences on Ancient Greek and Roman Law by Raymond Westbrook. And I have no doubt that this is a fascinating book. And I want to read it, but I did not want to read it today. And I certainly did not want to spend $48 or $49 Canadian on this book, and I did not want it instead of Designing the New American University by Michael M. Crowe. So I come here having not read the book, having been presented this alternative book, and what's really frustrating is they only gave me 2 pages of it. So this is a system that doesn't work. The book costs way too much. I'm sorry, Michael Crowe and William DeBars, but $48, I know you guys spent a lot of time on your book, and I'm sure it's good, but $48, really? And then I didn't even get the book. System is broken down. So that's what I'm trying to address. And, you know, you break it down. Lou mentioned I lead a program called Learning and Performance Support Systems. It's a government program. We've got millions of dollars funding, all of that. My life has become, instead of doing programming and things that I love, it's been doing budgets and value propositions and stuff, which I'm finding fascinating, which scares me, but it means that I need to be able to point to problems, pain points, they call them, and talk about what specific things the technology that we're trying to develop is supposed to do. And it's a different way of thinking for me, because I like to just go into a problem space and tinker until I come up with an answer that is, you know, something not like that ebook library. But, so I'm kind of focused on that. But I'm also focused on not so much trying to solve problems, but also trying to understand just what it is that we're up to. And that's an interesting question. And that's the question that, to me, has motivated a lot of the theoretical work behind the systems that I've developed, that we've developed. So there's two sides, right? There are two sides of the same problem. What are the problems? Well, stuff like that. How do we address the problems? Well, not doing stuff like that. Now, let's see if I can make my PowerPoint work the way it's supposed to. Okay. Okay. So, I thought I was actually doing this talk in Tempe. This is not Tempe, is it? It's Scottsdale, right? Not Glendale, that's where the coyotes are. So sorry about the first slide. There's a great big hill in Tempe, not here, with a big A on it. And I was going to open with, you guys have a nice hill with an A on it. And I looked at that and wondered what it was for. And spent the rest of the day looking for a hill with B on it. And you might think, why would I do that? I was watching... what was it called? Last Comic Standing last night on the television. And I don't know if any of you watch it. I love stand-up comedy. It's one of my favorite things. And it's a fascinating discipline. We have a comedian in Canada by the name of Mike Bullard. And what he says is, I mean, he's really a bad comedian, but he has a good theory of comedy. And his theory of comedy is this. Find something in common with the audience. Bring them around to your point of view. Make them laugh at themselves. And thinking about that, they give you advice. Right? Do a joke to start off your talk. And it's not to make the audience laugh. It's to do that first thing, right? Find a point in common with the audience. And that's kind of what happens in these talks, at least good ones, like this one. Sorry. Right? And so I'm trying to find a point in common. Well, what would be a point? It would be a big A on the hill, a point in common, right? And now I'm going to try to shift you around to see that A from my point of view, right? So what's my point of view? Well, I'm a Canadian A. No, let's see. That's a joke I knew wouldn't work. Her might. How many of you are Canadian? Oh, just a couple? I thought there might be more. anyhow, that kind of thinking, although it might seem like a long wander around to get to the point, that kind of thinking is the kind of thinking we need to be thinking about when we're thinking about how to make online learning work. So, one of the topics of this talk, and I know it's taking me 10 minutes to get to it, because I'm fighting off the heat stroke, is open content. And everybody thinks of open educational resources as, well, almost like books, like that one I almost read on the flight. But I don't want you to think of them that way. Think of open educational resources. Think of any of the resources that you create or you use, not like books, not like movies or whatever, but like words in a conversation. What does that mean? Why do I ask you to even think of them that way? Because thinking of them that way forces us to think about how they're going to be used, not simply how they are used. but how they can be used. Because when we're looking at them as words in a conversation, they now acquire properties that they didn't have when they were textbooks or when they were videos or whatever. Think about how words are used now in education. The kind of words that are the traditional kind, organized in sentences, things like that. Think about how a lecture, for example, might be a 10,000 word presentation. I record these lectures and then I get them transcribed, and that's how I know they're 10,000 words. And then I send them to journals and they send them back to me saying, oh, you can't send us this. For one thing, it's way too long. Think about how the words are defined in a way to explain phenomena, to identify causes, to argue to conclusions. These words, if you will, are the tools that we use in teaching, right? Yeah, we use pictures, and we use animations, and we use games, but the core of what we're using is the word. These really constrain us, traditional words, especially as they're used in education today. Think about the constraints we put on ourselves. I saw the instructional design area that was over there. See, I'm still trying to establish this point in common, or I'll be doing that for the rest of the talk. I've been here for, what, an hour? I know this building. Our educational words are limited to objectives and educational purpose. They have to have, and Lou mentioned, the learning objects. We had the educational content wars back then. It's not a learning object unless it has educational content, so we were told. They must perform, say, one of Gagne's tasks, capture attention or whatever. The pedagogy of words, as words, is very limited. It's transfer. Look at what I'm doing now. I'm doing the only thing with words that I can right now. I'm sending them to you. That's about it. And all of you are sitting there listening because we're working with words. So, educational technology and educational theory changed. It began changing in the 70s, I would say, more or less. And it became more of not so much just a transmission, but the other kind of thing that we could do with words. It became more of a conversation, right? Everybody credits people like David Weinberger who was it with him? Clay Shirky? Clue Train Manifesto. Markets or conversations have great insight, but all of philosophy had been moving in that direction anyways, and Weinberger has a philosophical background. And, for those of you who are in education, you'll have read about transactional theory, Moore, and the rest of them. Again, this is that idea of conversation, right? Send something out, get a response. Ask a question, why, get an answer. Ask a question, how, get an answer. Now it becomes something a little more back and forth. That's also words. But what we're finding, and why things like establishing a common frame of reference becomes more important, is that the words, as they expand, as they grow, it means that our learning and knowledge in general becomes not just the product of an individual, but a product of a community. And we saw that movement begin to take hold in education as well. I'm sure many of you are familiar with Etienne Wenger, with the concept of communities of practice. And now we have wider uses of words, But now we have other concepts that are coming into play in the development of education and in the development of learning environments. And I'm trying to think of another word for learning environments, but that's the only one I can think of. Learning situations, learning practices. So we have part of the environment based on participation, living in the world, membership, all of that. And another part, which is what might be called reification, making real, making true, verifying, instantiating. So we have points of focus, documents, objects, monuments, etc. There's, you know, the different aspects of being in a community. It's what I try to capture when I take photographs. None of you read my newsletters, so you don't know about my photographs. But when I travel, I always try to take time to photograph the place that I'm in, and then use those photographs in my presentation. And again, it's this establishment of something in common, but it's also this idea that in a community like this, like Guadalajara, like wherever, people talk not just with words. They express themselves with their monuments, with their artwork, with their buildings, with their parks, and all the rest of it. And I'm trying to see that, see what is being said to me, and reflect that back. And so I think of objects, of photographs of chairs, of napkins, whatever. I think of them all as though they are words. And I think of an open educational resource, or any educational resource, as a word in a dialogue that takes place in a community, rather than this thing that has syntax and semantics that is a sign that signifies something. See what I'm getting at with that? I'm seeing some nods, so that's good. All right. So that's the theoretical background. So what are open educational resources? Open educational resources, if we read from the UNESCO, range from textbooks to curricula, syllabi, lecture notes, assignments, tests, projects, audio, video, and animation. These are all the traditional sorts of educational uses of open educational resources, falling back into that kind of transmission mode of learning. We deconstruct open educational resources. We see that they're objects. They represent knowledge and understanding. But when I'm... Sorry, I've lost my train of thought. I'm going to blame the heat stroke. What I want to say, if we look at open educational resources from the perspective that they are words in this conversation, however, then we see them more as simply representations of knowledge and understanding. We see them as ways that people can communicate and talk back and forth to each other. So what follows is the idea of students themselves as the authors of open educational resources. So let's take that to the next step. If we deconstruct a sentence, the typical sentence has a subject, object, verb kind of construction. And that's what we see in the world of educational resources today. But what we find is that if we analyze sentences more deeply, that a complex sentence can have a much deeper structure. And I'm not just talking about the Chomsky deep structure that is inherent in the sentence itself. What I'm talking about is all of the... Sorry, I've lost my mouse. All right. It's the two screens. So sometimes the mouse is on the other screen. So, for example, I have most. See, here's the problem with this setup. Oh, I'm amused by such small things. So, if we do a modern analysis of the meaning of a sentence, we find ourselves caught up in other things like quantification, inference, causality, modality, etc. We're caught up in factors such as vagueness and ambiguity. I wrote an entire master's thesis on context sensitivity of sentences and models, idioms and metaphors, and ultimately, in order to understand any given sentence, any piece of language, you find yourself in a rich conceptual environment. There's much more in the sentence than is in the sentence itself. We really see this in social media. Here's an analysis of a tweet. A tweet is, of course, 148 characters, but there's a lot more going on in the metadata. If you look at the metadata produced by Twitter for a tweet, they would distribute this along with the actual text. We have the real name of the person who sent it, the Twitter name, a way to follow them, an indication of whether it's a favorite, a retweet option, hashtags associated with the tweet, a web link associated with the tweet, mentions, there's geolocation, there's time, etc. There's all kinds of stuff about the tweet over and above the 140 characters in the tweet. I've looked at this quite a bit more deeply, and I recommend this as a field of study. Lolcats. And the lolcat is a word in a conversation, isn't it? And if you think about it, a lolcat has really three major parts. It has the picture, preferably, but not necessarily including a cat. There are non-cat lolcats. It's okay, but really, if you're a purist, you should have a cat. Then it has some text, typically, I has idiosyncratic conjugation. And then the third part actually isn't in the lolcat. The third part is the contextual surround. Now, if I show this lolcat to my grandmother, it would be a miracle because she's no longer with us, but if she was and I showed it to her, she'd sort of scratch her head and I don't get it. And when lolcats first came out, we got that reaction a lot. People look at them and, I don't get it. Why is the cat wanting a cheeseburger anyways? But the idiosyncratic grammar, the idea of cats saying intelligent things unintelligently, and so on. There's a whole social mythology of cats, the idea that cats love to be in small, confined places, things like that. That is the third part of a lolcat. So we have image, text, surround. And it's interesting because you can be expert or non-expert at lolcats. You can be, I've looked at hundreds and hundreds, probably thousands of lolcats because I can. And they still pay me. And you can see, especially after your first thousand, you can see some people get it and other people don't, right? You see the lolcat is just a cat. I are a cat. Not funny at all, right? But why not, right? Is that touching of something in common, the reaching out, the connecting with the community, that's all important. OERs are like lolcats. OERs are lolcats. Your learning resources that you're designing are lolcats. So, Learning is where conversations happen. That's a terrible sentence, and I'm sorry I said it. What do I want to say here? So, I wanted to talk about Matt Bury. Oh, yeah. This is a bit of an aside, Matt Bury. There's this big debate in the field about, do learning styles really exist? Which is the most confused debate in the world, because I have no idea what it would be for a learning style to really exist in the first place. But the problem is, say the critics, you cannot design instruction based on differentiated learning modalities and achieve a statistically significant difference in the learning outcomes. That's the argument. There's a bunch of issues with that argument. One of the issues is the idea that we're presenting learning content in different modalities in order to produce statistically significant differences in learning outcomes, which I don't think is what we're trying to do at all. But the other thing is this presumption that for something to be a learning style has to be innate, we have to design for it, etc. And Matt Bury came up with what I thought was a really good discussion just last week about the idea that learning styles are something that are learned as opposed to innate. So, and he points to the difference, for example, between the expert and the novice learner, and poses the question, would we design instruction the same way for an expert learner as a novice learner? And clearly not. Okay, I'm wandering, and I saw somebody pointing to his clock. Yeah. Okay. So that's the setup, and I'm sorry, I am wandering, and I'm going a little off topic. And I am going to blame the heat. So let me talk now about how we approached, given all of that, how we approached the design of learning and performance support system. What we understand from the outset is that in order to provide learning and performance support, it's not just the creation of a book like a textbook or whatever. It's not just the presentation of content. Knowing that somebody has learned is not just getting them to regurgitate the content. And in fact, it's not even about contents at all. It's about having an actual learning environment. And so we sat down and we analyzed what the different components of what one of these learning environments needed to have. And to my mind, probably the first and foremost and most significant part is the connection of the individual to the learning environment that they're in. And everyone's is different. So we have something that we built called Resource Repository Networks. And the idea here is to provide that interactive layer. And the mechanism, most especially for bringing in and organizing the world around them. Now, those of you who've been on the internet for a while might recognize this as sort of almost like an RSS reader, except on the left-hand side, which is the sources of the information, we're looking at much more than just RSS feeds. We're looking at more than just articles and things like that. Oh, she's back. I thought it was an editorial comment. I thought, oh no, I'm losing them. I'm the Mike Bullard of academic talks. Mike Bullard would get that. So we have RSS, we have Open Archives Initiative, which is like RSS. We have SharePoint, Facebook, Twitter, Monster, which is job ads, government repositories, Desire to Learn, Coursera courses, edX courses, etc. The whole range of things that our aggregator goes out and retrieves content from. This is a partial list. But unlike an RSS reader, which just takes this content and dumps it, we take this content and we apply this personal context to it. So we parse it, we scrape it, we apply some analytics to it, blah, 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 tech talk. Based to a significant degree on the personal context. That is to say, the content that comes in your instance of this service and gets analyzed and then stored looks different after the analysis than my content. And the reason for that is that you see the content differently than I do. It has a different relevance to you. It has a different meaning, a different impact to you. If you have an objective, say, of learning how to tie fishes or fly fishing flies, I don't know anything about fishing. But if you do, then you're going to take that content and store it differently than I would, because I would just throw it away. I'm not interested in fishing. Anyhow, and we organize it and basically extract entities out of it and relate those entities to each other. So we have a whole set of entities that we identify: articles, photographs, persons, authors, organizations, events, job opportunities, etc. What's significant about the way we do this is we do not define ahead of time what things are and what they have to be. And that might seem like, well, an odd statement to me. But typically, when you're working with data in this way, in a typical data management environment, you have to define ahead of time what all of your objects are and what all the possible properties of those objects can be. We don't. We have set it up so that we can create new object types on the fly, and we can assign properties on the fly, because we don't know what you're going to see before you see it. We don't know what objects are going to be important to you until they're important to you. And we don't presume that everybody will see objects in the same way. I don't want to get into a long discussion of the banking theory of learning, but the difference here is the content is presented to you as something that you're going to work with and build on, as opposed to something that you're just going to take, store, and accumulate. In the traditional model of education, education as language, notes, assignments, a test, etc., you're working on this banking theory where you're just trying to accumulate facts. But in the model that I'm describing here with the RRN, what we're trying to do is build a large set of structures or relations. So underlying the system that I've just described is a graph database. We developed one for ourselves. Now we're using one called Neo4j because it supports most of the properties that we need in order to create the graph. What's important about the graph database is, first of all, that the objects are kind of free-form in the way that I've just described. But also, what's significant is that the objects are related to each other, and the graph database captures the relationships between these objects. We don't define ahead of time an ontology or a particular way of viewing the world or a structure of learning resources or of knowledge in general, but rather we capture that, create that, and build that on the fly based on the person's different experiences. I'm skipping a few things, but what we're trying to do here is take the learning that a person is doing and put it in the wider context of the other interactions, the other activities that they're undertaking. The name of our program is learning and performance support systems. And it implies not just a gathering of knowledge and information just in case you need it, but rather a support, learning and support that takes place in an actual context, in an actual environment. Typically in a work environment, but I'm trying to think of, you know, a wider way of looking at it. So it's a work environment, a living environment, a hobby environment, whatever. It's interesting, we look at open educational resources, we think of them as though they're books, we think of them as though they're learning resources or distance education that have been designed. But really the way open educational resources began is the way the Khan Academy began, the way so much of the stuff that's out there on the internet began. Some guy trying to make something quickly, in this case, bad videos. I shouldn't say it like that. They're good in their own way. But, you know, just quick off-the-cuff videos to support learning for a particular purpose and not to create something that would be in a library or last for all time. That's how I got into this game. I used to teach logic at a college. I created something called Stephen's Guide to Logical Fallacies, not because I wanted to create an open educational resource for all time, but because I thought this would be a really useful way to not have to answer the same questions over and over again. So in performance support, we see that these resources come into play at different points of an activity. Long before the activity to prepare, which is where most educational activity happens, right before the activity as you're planning for it, during the activity when you're doing an operation or welding something or whatever, and then after the activity when you're reflecting on it and you're adding your own experience or correcting your own mistakes. And it's that the performance is where we want to produce the support, but it's in the after part where we're actually creating the open educational resources themselves. In the case of personal learning, resources are produced after the interaction with the environment, with the welder or whatever, drawing in expert knowledge, drawing in existing content, but drawing in the actual experience with whatever was done. So a learning resource is something that's actually created on the fly as opposed to something that's designed well ahead of time. Lou, I think, expressed surprise when I said at the start, you know, I record all of my talks. Why do I record my talks? Well, for one thing, it's so that there's evidence that I was actually there. No, I'm kidding. I record the talks because in the course of doing something like a talk like this, whether it's good, whether it's bad, whether it's anywhere in the middle, I'm capturing a record of it, and that record can become the learning resource that somebody following along can benefit from. Dave Cornier, who did EdTech Talks, used to say he did these live interviews with people, and they'd get on 15, 20 people in the live online webcast, and then you get hundreds of people listening to the interviews after. You know, it's the saving and sharing of the resource after that produced the most impact. And that's what I do here. So here I'm speaking to, what, maybe 100 people, but there may be 1,000 people over time, simply because I'm doing this recording, and all I needed to do to produce this recording was push a button, and then later I'll upload it. The concept is sometimes called working out loud. The idea of producing a resource at the same time you're doing something. The classic example of working out loud, the black box in an airplane. Now, normally, we only refer to that when our work didn't really go that well. But if you think about it, in any case of flying an airplane, any event, that black box is recording what you're doing. And these black boxes, an actual performance while flying a plane, can be and indeed is fed back into learning systems in order to produce the next go-round, the next generation, if you will, of learning resources. It's an incredibly powerful concept. As we work with airline companies, and they sometimes talk about closing the loop, right? And closing the loop here, in this case, is the learning to the performance, closing the loop back to the learning. And then the learning to the performance, closing the loop to back to the design of the learning. So that you're able to improve the individual's learning, you're able to improve the environment that designs the individual's learning. And then you just keep feeding it back, closing the loop. The U.S. military, in some cooperation with Canadian military, is building on this with what they call a personal assistant for learning, or PAL. It's based on a bunch of existing open standards or specifications, some of which you may be familiar with, some of which you may not, I don't know. I haven't been here long enough to know what you know and what you don't know. But it's based on things like open badges, which are a mechanism for crediting particular pieces of work. It's based on the Learning Resource Metadata Initiative, which is the latest iteration, if you will, of learning object metadata. It's based on the Experience API. The Experience API is a subject-object verb type of representation of learning activities. Probably not enough to be sufficient, but enough to get started. And on a learning registry. And the idea here is that using these different technologies, you can create a learning environment that provides individual and personal support for a person. Okay, well, that's a good idea, and we like that idea. But how do you pull this off? What we're building, in addition to the other stuff that you've seen so far, is what we call the personal learning record. Personal learning record includes three major areas. One area, the parts that I've just talked about, badges, certificates, etc., credentials, competencies, all of these are records of achievement. All of these are things that would be earned or received by an individual, probably verified or authenticated by a third party. Then there are the activity records themselves. The activity records are like the black box, right? You crashed your plane. If you come back to teach something or to learn something again, your black box would feed into your personal learning record. Generally, though, this is what happens in a simulator or a modeled environment where you definitely are coming back. Any sort of learning activity that you undertake would show up here. And then finally, there are the things that you create in the process of learning, things like portfolios, artifacts, papers, reports, any sort of evidence. And these things that you create in this context of these resources, in this context of having just completed some sort of activity, whether it's a learning activity or an actual on-the-job activity, that's what produces the open educational resource, the learning resource for the next go-round. And that gets fed out into the system and aggregated by other people, aggregated through the resource repository network. So you sort of see what's happening here, right? The OER is one person's way of talking to another person. The OER is me describing my experience of crashing my 737 in the simulator and passing that on to the next guy so that they know not to crash their 737 in the simulator. Okay, bad example, but you know what I mean. People these days are focused on building OERs. My argument is there is this huge, incredibly huge, already existing infrastructure out there with thousands upon millions of open educational resources, most of which have been produced by communities in authentic environments in just this way. One of my favorites is Vegan Black Metal Chef. Look it up. It really exists. But there are things like Stack Overflow for programmers, WebMD, DeviantArt, Ask the Builders, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these sites. And then there are ways we can produce OERs on the job. This is a particular example, not one of my favorites, because anything to do with medicine and blood, I'm not really big on. But this is one way of producing a live OER. So I feel like I've skipped very lightly with some digressions through this. I've got a few more minutes. Let me talk briefly about some of the stuff, the specific stuff that we've been working on, and it might give you a sense of the way some of these pieces fit together. So first of all are the MOOCs that we did with George Siemens and myself, Dave Cormier, and you know, cast of thousands. Notice the thing I want you to see here is that we designed these MOOCs. Now, these are the original MOOCs, the ones that we built, not like books, not like texts, not like traditional kinds of learning, but rather, normally I point to the big screen here, but rather like networks, like webs of connectivity where we have various different resources, various different services, and of course all the people in the course all connected together. The idea here is that when we're building a course, we're not building a structured representation of knowledge, we're building a community where this interaction, this conversation that I've been talking about can happen. And people bring in their experiences, bring in their resources, exchange them with each other, and then the conversation about those resources takes place. I did a project called PLERN. PLERN was my name. It stands for Personal Learning Environment and Resource Network. I thought it was a great name. You know, what are you doing? I'm PLERNing. Who are the people? You know, you have PLERNers. They hated it. They so hated the name. I loved the name. Anyhow, so what we did, we did a bunch of, we had the various courses, we had personal learning, networks, it was called PLENK, PLENG, Personal Learning Environments, Networks, and Knowledge. And we did a course on change, etc. So we did a lot of analyses of that, and we built a prototype personal learning environment, which we called PLERN, and what we saw in that, analyzing these MOOCs in that environment, was the importance of the graph. We did not build PLERN with a graph database, so PLERN, the technology, was horribly, agonizingly slow. It's a lesson we've learned from the next go round. We're not using an SQL database, we're using the graph database. Something else we did, again, that taught us a lot about the importance of community and how different aspects of community come into play, is something for the Organisation Internationale de Francophonie, or the Organization of French-Speaking Countries around the World. We did a MOOC for them on open educational resources, or as they say in French, ressources éducatives libres. And this was interesting. We did it with the University de Moncton. They focused more on the traditional, let's make a bunch of videos model of MOOCs, and it wasn't as successful as we would have liked. Hopefully we're doing a second go-round of this, and we're going to focus much more on the local community-based aspect of offering this MOOC. And the idea is now we'll be able to compare MOOCREL first edition, MOOCREL second edition, and compare the video version with the community-based version. I think it'll be an interesting result. Another project is for something called the Privy Council Office. And that's a government department in Canada. Badges for Learning. We're trying to investigate how to make learning credentials work inside and outside a secure intranet. The Privy Council office is one of the top offices in Canada. It's very close to the Prime Minister. They deal with a lot of secure stuff. People who get training in the Privy Council office are awarded with badges. That's great, but if they can't show the badges to anybody, that's not so great. So we are investigating how to show to the public badges that were earned in a secure environment. Secure environments, this is OnGuard. I forget what it stands for. It's an acronym. But basically, it's a sandbox that we've set up for security services in Canada, the Armed Forces, CSIS, which is Canadian Security Intelligence Service, Security Establishment, the RCMP, Coast Guard, and there's a bunch of other security agencies. The problem that these agencies have is they all work in really secure environments, which means they can't share with each other. It's a real problem. And so what we've done is we've set up this common sandbox. It began as a Moodle and Mihara environment, but what we're doing is we're sticking the personal learning environment in there so that people can come in, they have their personal learning environment, they have their personal learning record and their resource network, and they're able to get performance support from this common area that they can share on an individual basis with other members in the community, even though they're working in these secure environments. It's a logistical nightmare, but it's a really interesting challenge. We're also looking at capacity building in things like the Arab League Educational, Cultural, and Scientific Organization. Again, they're interested in open educational resources. Again, they're interested in seeing these resources as a cultural resource, a way for a community to talk to itself, as opposed to simply a content transmission kind of resource. MINT, or Mobile Interactive Trainer, is an interesting system in that the idea here is that we're projecting the capacities of the personal learning environment into a physical device. In this case, it's a firearm simulator that uses lasers. And the idea here is not we're trying to train people on firearms, not really interested in that. What I am interested in is capturing the data that that produces, bringing that back in, turning that into learning activity records, putting them in a learning record store, or LRS, and then creating elements of the learning graph out of that so that we can mix that information with other information in order to support learning recommendations for the future. Same sort of thing, but with medical simulations. This is work that's being done on what's called the NeuroTouch Simulator. It's also a part of our program. And again, they create activity records from people who are using, I'm pointing at my screen, people who are using actual instruments that are used in neural surgery. They're connected to a simulator instead of a brain, which is safer that way, especially for the brain. And the records are created and they're sent back into the personal learning environment, into the personal learning record. And it's interesting. The idea here is you could use, in our case, the same environment. So now we have somebody who in the morning went out and did some firearms training, and then in the afternoon went out and did some neurosurgery, and no, they're not related. But the idea is both of those come back into the same system, and they come into a graph database, and the graph database is based on sets of connections or relations. A lot of these are sub-symbolic. A lot of these are non-representational. There may be patterns of activities in common between these two very different things that we don't know about, we can't predict, They have no idea what they would look like, but they would show up in a graph database. Whereas if we used a traditional SQL database with words and structures and models kind of representation, we would be completely blind to it. It would be impossible for us to detect any sort of relation like that. Concierge is something that's completely different, but uses the same underlying technology. Small and medium-sized enterprises in Canada are matched with federal grants and granting services. So it's a matching kind of exercise, but again, we're creating an individual personal learning environment for each person in a small and medium-sized enterprise, connecting them with each other and allowing them to have their learning activities or all of their activities become part of their own personal learning record. So we connect the enterprise to activities, to events, to learning resources, to bidding opportunities for federal government contracts, to bidding opportunities for multinational enterprise contracts, etc. And you might think, what does that have to do with simulations of medical, of neurosurgery, etc.? The idea, again, is you can take these, represent these at the graph level, and create recommendations out of them by observing patterns in what they're doing. And we're using the very same system for this as for that. So you could have, now getting crazy with the scenario, a person who in the morning went out and practiced with firearms, in the afternoon did some practice with neurosurgery, and has a small to medium-sized enterprise marketing some tools to, I don't know, guns and health people. And it would all happen in the one and the same system. So what's really significant about this is you can't do this in one big database. You can't do this in a Facebook or an Amazon or a Google or an Ashley Madison or a whatever, right? And the reason why you can't, two major reasons, and I'm almost at the end here, but two major reasons, and ultimately, these are the problems we're trying to solve, really, when you get to it. And you don't really see that you're trying to solve them until the end. The first reason is everybody's different. Everybody is different. No two people see the world the same way. No two people represent the world the same way, have the same set of interests. If you're doing recommendations and you want them to be good recommendations, if you're doing learning support, path recommendation, learning path recommendations, etc., it has to be done differently for each person. So, in a sense, yes, there are learning styles, it's just we each have one of our own. The second reason is, if we put them all in one big database, like Google or whatever, it would be a huge, gross invasion of privacy. Think about what we need to do to get this individual personal learning record. You have to get your Google, all your social media interactions, all the work you did on the simulators, all the work you've done in your professional life, etc. All of that together in one place, which is your personal learning record. If we kept all of those in a single environment, it would be far too tempting a target. If we keep each one of those separate, the way we keep these separate rather than stored in a single common place, it makes them a lot harder to steal, and it makes them much more private. So we're solving, on the one hand, the question of personal data security, and on the other hand, the problem of individual learning profiles producing individual learning paths and learning recommendations. So that basically is the LPSS program. We've got the major elements, personal learning record, resource repository networks, et cetera. We've got some of these programs, like MINT, the Interactive Trainer, Alexa, OIF, MOOCs, et cetera. And then we have the analytics and other tools that we're able to gather from the National Research Council, because it's much more than just one program. We work with external applications, and we interact with the rest of the Internet. And, I had an hour, and I took an extra 10 minutes, sorry. I'm only able to touch the surface of what we did. Every digression was taken away from that, but the digressions are important. It's like these talks, they can never be exactly the same. If I gave you exactly the same talk that I gave to some other group, it would be the wrong talk. They've all got to be individual. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But I thank you for your time and your attention. I really appreciate you coming out here and staying even after all the pizza was gone.
We've got a couple of meetings to do, so we'll start it over.
Okay.
So what I'd like to do is, just where you left off, you were starting to get into one of the more architectural
stuff. Yeah.
So I think if we start there, it'd be really good. And then we can